Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, we are pleased to have with us Wiki Wang, author of Chemistry, her first novel, published in May by Knopf. Wiki is a graduate of Harvard, where she earned her undergraduate degree in chemistry and her doctorate in public health. She received her MFA from Boston University, and her fiction has been published in Plowshares, Glimmer Train, Redivider, and others. Chemistry is an academic novel of sorts. It's a love story, too, and a life journey as well, but it's the academic side of it that I really like because it's really, really funny. I learned that a Chinese proverb dictates that a mastery of math, physics, and chemistry leads to fearlessness anywhere in the world. I also learned that our unnamed narrator, who tutors science students, feels that they want the mastery of this knowledge delivered through a tube uploaded by the tutor at their weekly sessions. I learned that the triangle is the strongest of shapes. As Wiki says, when you think geometry, think triangles. So what is so strange about this book and so enchanting is that that sentence is followed with a sentence that says she has a desire to design apartments that do not echo, a revocation of sound's ability to echo in the first place. So it's strange, but it's cool. So whether I'm learning that there's a mineral that's 58% harder than diamonds, lonsdaleite, which can only be made by smashing meteorites together, kinda, or that there's something called an argon box that chemistry students use to do their experiments, or when the experiments go wrong, want to put their heads inside of, I was always learning. The key to this book is that each little factoid, aphorism, or hint from Stephen Hawking is also a hint at our narrator's life situation, which is a pretty gnarly one. She has a great boyfriend, a pretty horrible academic career going on, and a seeming inability to decide pretty much anything. She's also a bit of a drunk. So the question is, as we learn and read, where is she going to end up? Which I can't tell you, and I don't even know for sure where she does end up. But the trip is lots of fun, and even though we feel for, I call her Samantha, because I gave her that name, even though we feel for her, we also are able to laugh out loud through the whole of this short but jam-packed first novel. With that, Wiki, welcome, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. That's funny that you named her Samantha. That name hadn't occurred to me, but that sounds fitting.
We have to go back and like line through it. Well, first of all, I will say this for everybody out there. Buy this book because it has the best epigraph of any book ever written.
Oh, thank you. That was actually, I have to give credit. When we were trying to figure out an epigraph, I had a lot of ideas, and my editor actually thought this one was interesting, and we sort of delved into it together.
it's great, and I won't even say what it is, but like all epigraphs, which is really funny, it really does set the mood for the book, because isn't it just like her? I mean,
right. I think the narrator, she's very literal.
Exactly.
She's trying to think outside that box, and I think that's where some of the her funny instances comes in that she's trying to figure out when to be literal and when to be not literal.
and that's the thing is it's kind of a shame because you think, and this is kind of like a saying she would mess up. Like, how does she get herself into such a pickle when she has a legal pad that has only pros on it and no cons?
Right. She is thoughtful. I think she tries her best to reason through everything, and that can be a virtue, right? And ultimately, she finds that there's a lot of things that are beyond reason, and even scientists have to admit that there's a lot of things that they just don't know. That is actually one of the first things when you go into any sort of scientific PhD or doctorate is that you quickly learn the extent of human knowledge. And a good scientist is actually a scientist who admits that he or she doesn't really know what's going on.
Yeah, I know. I was watching this documentary last night called Particle Fever about CERN.
Ooh.
And the head theoretical physicist was saying, failure after failure after failure after failure is resounding success.
And
it's so true, but is that true?
It doesn't feel good when it happens.
I don't know if it translates to life, though. You know,
right. The failure after failure.
Yeah.
I think as a person, you shouldn't fail as much as scientists do. That would be essentially a 99% failure rate.
I was just going to say, I think he said fail spectacularly, and I think that's what scientists really love.
Right. It's true. Yeah.
It's funny when I was listening to the NPR interview that you did over the weekend, and a gentleman was talking about, you know, the parents in this book and how their relationship and how screwed up it is kind of affects her inherently. But I was reading the other day about, you know, someone was saying there's a certain point in your life when you have to stop blaming what's wrong with your life on the path that your parents set you out on.
Exactly.
And has she gotten there? Is she getting there?
I think she's getting there. I really like that you picked that line, because it's a line that actually launched how I thought about this narrator's relationship with her parents, and that the goal wasn't necessarily to ever vilify parents, especially Asian parents. I think I wanted her to realize that parents are very complicated, and as much as parents try to seem like they have it all together, just like maybe scientists do, they don't. And parents make mistakes. Or are not always sure. And at a certain point, there's, you know, the point is not very distinct. You never know. It's sort of at a certain point, you realize you're on your own. And that I think is what she's also realizing too, that it's easy to blame all of her feelings on maybe kind of a strange upbringing, but she's also learning to take responsibility for some of the ways that she acts. And who she is as a person.
You know, it's funny how you made Eric so nice. You know, it's like it's like I would have married him. I would have said yes. I love the way he not only puts the toothpaste on the toothbrush for her, but puts the toothbrush
in
her mouth.
Sticks it in her mouth.
And it's still not enough for her to commit.
Right. I think the reason I wanted to make this kind of character is that I didn't want her to say, oh, I don't want to marry Eric because he has this many flaws. I actually just wanted to make Eric this character that most anybody would probably say yes to. And she really needs to find that she's not saying yes because he's so great, that she's saying yes because she also wants to. So I try to make it hard for her. because I think if she had one con, she would have let that con take over that list. And I wanted her to really have to think about why she's saying no to essentially a great deal from any outsider's point of view.
And it's funny the way you did it. You made a secondary great deal too when she's tutoring and she has the student who's the hot student, and you know, she kind of doesn't really pick up on the fact. Even when they go bowling, you know, that he, you know, would like to be with her as well. And she doesn't really like, it's like a not starter for her. And I wondered about that, because this guy's really hot, right?
Right. A good looking guy. And she's just very oblivious to it.
I like the
I
way
think it also, right. And I think I also, you know, it's just how she perceives the like and love, and it's not exactly she's aware of a lot of things, but not maybe the most obvious thing to most people.
the things about her that Eric would be if he was capable of being exasperated, if he was capable of it, the things that he would be most exasperated about are exactly the same way I am, like when she's in when she's in Home Depot and feels like she's in hell. I know that feeling very well, and I have a feeling you do too. And and also when she's in kind of like Sam's Club getting the free food,
right?
You know, where I always go and I take my kids. And there is some type of It's like being in a perfectly organized Target or something like that. You do have this feeling of comfort, other than the fluorescent lights. You have a feeling of comfort, like, you know, things are a little more stable.
Things are where they're supposed to be. It's simplistic. And I think she also likes not having to really interact with that many people when you're at this crowded place.
Except when she tries to explain centripetal force to that kid. The kid is happy, you know? He's like, I'm happy that she's explaining this to me, but you can't do that in today's world, right? Which is a shame.
No, you can't.
That was a very nice scene. That's where the real her comes out, I think. In that scene, if I had to say something, I would say in that scene where she wants to explain to him why it spins around, you know, she has this knowledge, she knows the way the natural world works, and she wants somebody to know that. There's a certain kind of goodness in that.
And I think she just wants everybody to see the world like she sees it a little bit. She wants to share that, even though it's not necessarily the most straightforward way to look at the world. But I think she's grappling with, she sees a lot of beauty in the world because of how she understands science, but she also has this very strained relationship with science given her actual occupation. So she's really trying to rediscover what made her appreciate science in the first place.
Yeah, and you do that. It's really interesting when I said an academic novel. I mean, there is a section that starts, which is headed, a list of famous chemists. And then you list Nobel, Haber, and Grignard.
And
they're all horrible people.
But nobody really, I mean, I think once your accomplishments are so great, your personality becomes less of a, even if you're not necessarily the nicest person, it becomes less of an issue.
Well, that's why she said, she says it's a double-edged sword.
Right. And I think I first learned about Nobel and how, you know, he invented TNT in my inorganic chemistry class in undergrad. That's really the only thing I remember from that class was learning that Nobel was a terrible person.
Yeah, and look, he realized it too, and he tried his best to make up for
it. Right, yeah.
But then, you know, you go back to what happens to her when she's in her class, you know, and she's got all this pressure, especially from her advisor, who's a jackass. But but he's funny. But you know, the idea of people breaking, when she breaks the beakers on the floor, when she has the kind of friend who falsifies the data because she's under so much pressure. Does that actually happen when you were in school? Was there so much
in every, you know, falsifying data is something that is not new to this lab. In any field, in biochemistry, physics, there are instances of data fabrication, and then magazines or journals would have to recall. It's very, very rare, but when it does happen, it's sort of a common thing that it's not unusual, right? It's sort of like in doctors, there's malpractice. That's sort of, if you ask any doctor, they would say malpractice is obviously a thing. Those are not necessarily based on real events I experienced, but based on real events in any kind of research environment. Having individuals driven kind of crazy by this desire to accomplish, the desire to publish, and to get somewhere. So in a way they were real because there is precedence for all of that kind of behavior, but I definitely fictionalize it by having her interact with those kind of events, sort of putting them all in one terrible lab.
Yeah. It's funny. It's like the other things that she does that's, again, something I know that I do and I have a feeling you do is when she looks at the, when she's in the supermarket and she looks at the label and it says no added chemicals. And she realizes, why don't they know that everything in there is chemicals? Which is true, right?
Yeah, it is true. Everything's made of chemicals.
And what bothers me, too, is how people get all upset about irradiated food when everything we've ever eaten has been irradiated by a radioactive source.
Right. The word radioactive, I think, sets alarms off in people's heads, where it can mean a multitude of different things. Radioactive, having half-lives, decaying. Everything has a half-life. Carbon decays. That's how we're able to date historic fossils. I think to point out, her ultimate frustration is seeing that this sudden phobia against chemicals when everything is made of chemicals, and the sudden phobia against things that there are certain chemicals that are dangerous, in the book I mentioned that it's a dosage question, essentially.
Right, and when you were talking about the girls making the watches and the radium.
Right.
So if this book was looked at kind of like musically, and you were juxtaposing things, the best friend would be that juxtaposition. Mm. And she's in a situation where it seems like she has the world by the tail. The world is her oyster. More cliches that could be messed up. but she handles it completely differently than our narrator would. But our narrator gets intimately involved in the situation. What made you feel like, this is a good idea? I need to bring this in because it's going to add, because it did. It added a lot to the book. It really did. It made it multidimensional.
Right.
So what were you thinking?
Well, I think because she's a lonely narrator. First, my thinking structurally was, once Eric leaves, I think she's going to need friends.
You had a dog.
I had a dog, but unfortunately, dogs can't talk. So I needed to structurally put in another character to fill out the second part. But I wanted to find a friend that was very different from her, that she kind of went through the process of having a strict upbringing, having certain expectations, needing them, and then professionally, all of that is fine, and then something personally, in a similar way as the narrator, personally implodes, right? It's kind of out of her control. I like that aspect, is that in that both their lives are kind of personally, their personal lives take a hit, essentially, in these 2 years. One, with the narrator, it kind of spills out from her personal or her professional problems. She has to deal with how she feels about accomplishment and that whole theme of accomplishment. And with the best friend, I wanted her to be this professional powerhouse, but also have personal problems, just because sometimes that's how life works, that you could be great in every aspect and then sometimes things just don't work out. So a little bit of chaos in there.
Yeah, in the beginning, when I started reading about the best friend, I wanted to have her life too. It was like, she had everything. She was financially set up. She was going to have a baby. They had a great time together and all that.
Right.
And then she still, but what the best friend does that our narrator doesn't do, that's exactly what, the best friend can rationalize.
Right.
And the narrator cannot rationalize.
Right. Mm-hmm.
When you said she was literal, she definitely is, and she doesn't allow herself the luxury that most human beings do on a day-to-day basis.
Right, exactly.
That's why I like her so much.
Yeah, I mean, I think I wanted to keep the cast of characters small. I have trouble, even when I'm reading, following books with a huge cast of characters. I end up having to draw up family trees and write those things down, but with this novel, I really wanted, and with most of my stories, I like to keep everything small, but have these small worlds explore bigger worlds, bigger internal worlds.
Yeah, well, what's interesting is that what you do with single lines is fascinating. Like when you're talking about Eric, and she talks mm-hmm. about Eric's life is an arrow going in a specific direction, whether it's to Oberlin or wherever it's going to. Whereas when you look at her life, it's just this exploding volume of gas going in all directions. So what the reader does, and this doesn't happen in novels a lot because novels aren't written like your book. So what the reader does is the reader starts thinking about, okay, well, I wonder what my life would look like. You know, it gives you, there's a commentary, you know, it's like the Torah or something. There's a commentary that goes along with the book. It's like when you say Einstein says that the only energy that humans haven't been able to drive is love.
Right.
That gives the reader a lot to think about, but it really doesn't have anything to do with the novel. I don't mean that in a bad way. That sounds horrible.
No. I understand. The way I wanted to write it was fragmented. It kind of mimics how she thinks. It mimics her life, and it mimics, I think, maybe the thought process of a scientist, that we're always trying to relate these bigger things to these smaller things.
Yeah, it's true. It's like you're in a relationship and you're thinking, is this supersymmetry or is this the multiverse? You know,
right.
What should I analogize this to?
It's a
fascinating first book, and the thing that's really cool about it. First, also the cover is really nice.
Thank you. The cover, you know, when they give you book covers, they don't really tell you that much, and then one day it just appears in your mailbox, and and it's wonderful. You have a few choices of color, but. Initially, it was a white cover, but then the talented artistry team behind it decided to make it a bright yellow, I think, to make it a little bit more fun, which is, I hope, what this novel is. I hope the reader has fun reading it, even though the narrator's maybe not having that much fun experiencing it.
I think she does. You know, that's the other thing. It's the funny thing is, and that's why when I was listening to the NPR thing, I'm thinking he's making this sound a little serious because he's talking about the knives underneath the pillows and how he was horrified by it. Well, you know, okay, whatever. But but it's not. It's really a really funny book.
Well, and I'm so glad that you see this too, because I had a lot of fun writing it. And I think one of the things that when I, you know, when I have writing students and when I teach writing students is that there needs to be a lot of levity to get across heavier issues,
exactly.
And you need that. Otherwise, the reader will get too inundated with these negative emotions or these heavy emotions. And I think when something bad happens, sometimes humor becomes a coping mechanism, and that's actually why she has this wonky way of trying to express her feelings.
Yeah, she has. You know, you could call it sarcasm or cynicism, but there is something behind her where she does recognize her own sense of humor, I think.
Right.
And it's kind of blurred sometimes because you're also trying to have her grow and you're also having her go through an emotional turmoil. But at the same time, especially when she's doing things like talking about the best friend's baby and stuff like that.
Right. I think her interactions actually come out, for me, when I was writing it, the best when she's interacting with kids. She thinks that she wouldn't actually be good with kids or she wouldn't be a great mom, but I think it's just funny when she interacts with a baby or she interacts with a boy in the supermarket.
well, think about it also when she interacts with her students as a tutor. And she's a really good tutor. That's what, you know, if I was going to say, okay, where's all this going? Well, I'm not going to say because I give it all away, but I can think of a life for her.
Right.
And you can too. I can think of a really good life for her where she's made this, at the very end, she makes this little start. And then that's one side of her life. And the other side of it is she could do really well being with children and young adults because she doesn't treat them like kids.
Yeah, I think she tries to talk to them in an adult way. She tries to teach them things that maybe she learned in college. and she really finds her, I wouldn't say necessary passion, because I think that may be an overused word, but she finds something she enjoys doing. And this is a narrator that is rarely that happy. I think she never has a problem of, you know, being too happy. And she finds for a moment that she's just happy doing something.
I think next time you should, your next book, you should do like a small sexual thing where she has an affair with the guy, with the student.
You should. That's really interesting because I did start something and it is about an affair. but it's not in the same world. It's not a sequel.
A sequel would be good, you know? A sequel wouldn't be bad. The last thing I was going to say, and then I'll let you go, is I do really love the cover, and I have this independent bookstore called Wellington Square Bookshop here in Chester County, and the yellow is like perfect because as many times as people tell me you can't judge a book by its cover, every single person who comes into my bookstore, without exception, does. And you know, then you have to watch out that it doesn't look like a chick lit book, it does have the universal symbol for a woman as she's going into the bathroom, kind of, but with the gas, you know, with a the atom going around her head. So it really is a really compelling cover, I think.
Yeah, I did make the request that I wanted nothing pink on the cover, so that orange color with my name, it looked pink in a lot of different versions, and I'm really glad it didn't come out pink because I think once pink comes into the picture, it automatically becomes more chick-lit, right?
Yeah, if she had been more feminized rather than turned into this uniform symbol. And also they gave you that glossy stuff on the black part, which is nice. And also it kind of looks like a textbook, which is pretty smart too.
Yeah, I mean, I hope it doesn't read like one, but...
No, it definitely doesn't. No, it was Now I would say it's definitely one of a kind, and that's what I'm always looking for when I'm reading, and I think many readers are too.
Thank you.
So I was really, really happy reading it, and we already have our copies on the front table at the bookstore.
Oh, wonderful. So, I mean, I think, you know, when you introduced me, it was really nice to hear that you learned this and you learned this, because when I read, I'm always looking to learn something. I love learning new things when I read, even if it's sort of one sentence about this island in the middle of nowhere or something about something I just didn't know before. And it warmed my heart when you said all those things that you didn't know before, but now this novel sort of...
I'm probably like you too, though, because what happens is, and this is where you can irritate me, is that if I'm reading this at one sitting, which I did, but then I start reading about Lonsdaleite, so what do? I go to Wikipedia, right? So then I start reading about it and then looking at images of it and then reading more about the discovery of it. And so, but that's, don't you think that's great? I mean,
that is good.
What could be better?
Right, exactly. And when I read great passages on music, what's better than reading it, listening to the song, right? It just motivates you to reach out of your normal, whatever normal things you read to try something different.
Yeah, and I won't mention certain authors' names that I've interviewed that are very popular authors, but you read their book, it's self-contained, they maybe have written 30 or 40 books like it, and, you know, who am I to say anything about it? Okay, yes, I guess I did like it and all, but it doesn't take you anywhere. And that's why I feel like this book does, and that's why I'm very happy with it.
Well, I'm so glad.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. And,
of course.
And then maybe sometime if you're ever around our area, you can come by and see us.
Yeah, I would love that.
Okay.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. Talk to you soon. That was Wiki Wang talking about her book Chemistry, which obviously I'm like a fanboy of now. And it's really, really good. And... I highly recommend it. It's a short 200 pages, and it's compelling. It's, at first you think, well, this isn't deep. It's just kind of cute, but it's more than that. It's a real good way of bringing one character to life, because it really is a one-person show, and it's this one woman on stage telling us who she is, And the stuff, the backstory, is what really gives you perspective into what kind of person she is. So anyway, we have I didn't bring my list of who's coming up next, but we have lots of great authors coming up through the summer, and Rebecca is lining up even more as we speak. So thanks, as always, for being such a good listener, and we hope you'll be with us next week here on The Avid Reader.